you can earn a substantial income, 8 times the average personal income, and more, by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city for the city. If this assertion is true, we simply must ask, how can one grow for big profit on a small parcel of land?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1,000th edition of the Food Chain, right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in the Tuscany who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Marlene Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards.
Hello, glad to be here.
Hey, Michael. Folks, there is a thought for the 90 million working-aged adults who have dropped out of the U.S. workforce. You can earn a substantial income, 8 times the average personal income and more, by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city for the city. You can be old or young, male or female, married or single, rich or poor. You can rent, lease, or own the land. You can succeed with small fruits on prairie benchlands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, and ornamentals in the neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There is only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. This competition among farmers is a foundation upon which most human activity is conducted. People somehow lost track of this elemental fact. Farming became the object of big city humor, and farmers the butt of many jokes. This attitude is even reflected in our language as illustrated in Webster's Third. Farmer, 4A, an ignorant rustic, yokel, bumpkin. B, clumsy, stupid fellow, dolt. C, slang, a green hand, inexperienced or incompetent at the trade at which he is working. This way of looking at the business of farming is decidedly unrealistic, as today's farmer must be a skilled technician, proficient in the technologies of agriculture and business. And so we must ask, given the fact that competition for the consumer's dollar is dominated by the large farms, vast amounts of capital, and friendly politicians, how can one growing on a small parcel of land win the competition? For this, the millennial edition of the Food Chain, we are turning the table on host Michael Olson and forcing him to prove up the contention made in his book, Metro Farm, that small farms can be both beautiful and profitable. Michael, for decades, ag economists have told farmers to get big or get out. What led you to stay small and stand tall?
Well, thank you, Marlene. Holy smokes. Folks, I have to introduce our host today, Marlene Olson. You know, so over 40 years ago, four decades ago, I met this cute blonde on a blind date in Billings, Montana. So smitten was I with her that I talked her into running away with me to California. And that was four decades ago. So we have been partners for a long, long time. And a big part of that partnership was the building of our Metro Farm book. I wrote it, but she built it. And it's as much her as it is me. So when we came to do this show today, I thought, who better to host the show than Marlene? And so thank you for being here for and all of that you have done to put this together. You're supposed to say, never mind.
Yahoo!
Okay, good enough. Well, so how did we come about this book, Metro Farm? It's kind of interesting because it goes back quite a ways to the time Marlene and I were working for NBC Magazine with David Brinkley. We were doing a piece on survivalists in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon. Survivalists are those people who have somehow come to believe that the that the economic house of cards that holds cities together is going to collapse. Now, where they got that idea, I have no idea, but somehow they believe that. And so they move more than one gas tank away from the nearest big city. Now, Rogue River, Oregon is more than one gas tank away from San Francisco Bay Area and more than one gas tank away from Portland. So if the bleep hits the fan, a lot of people head out of town, they're not going to make it all the way to the Rogue Valley because they're going to run out of gas. That's the principle, and that's why they were there. So we were standing on a hill overlooking the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, looking down on this beautiful, extraordinarily lush valley filled with beautiful farmland. Only nobody was farming anything. Everybody had divided up the land into little survivalist ranchettes, and they were all hunkered down with their cans of crackers and their guns waiting for Armageddon. And so we were up on top of a hill doing an establishing shot, and our talent, I think it was Jack Perkins at the time, was saying, like, beyond you could see the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon. This is where those survivalists hang out. And without thinking much of anything, you know, being a Montana farm boy, I turned to our guide, Nancy Mack Tappan, who is a publisher of survivalist tracks. And I said, Nancy, we should make a pamphlet on ways to make money with those small parcels of land. Nancy said, Michael, that's a great idea. Month later, I got a call from Nancy Mack Tappan, and she said, Michael, I sold your book. And I said, what book? And she said, the book about farming small parcels of land. So there it was. I had a book ready to go. I had a publisher. I had a publicist in the Empire State Building. And I didn't have the slightest idea what to do. So I went to the Census of Agriculture and was snooping around trying to figure out who actually grew crops and made money on small parcels of land. I came across an incredibly fascinating statistic. This is from the Census of Agriculture. Whereas the average acre of farmland in the heartland of America makes about $313 per acre per year, the average acre of farmland in the city limits of San Francisco was making $76,421 per acre per year. That statistic from the Census of Agriculture really kind of stopped me in my tracks. Holy smokes! It's really not the people who have run away from the city who are making the money. It's the people who are farming for the city, in the city, who are making the money. So we went looking for people who are actually doing this. Who the heck is making that kind of money on a small parcel of land? And so the first thing we did was kind of what we did when we were working on a marijuana piece for NBC. We rented a Cessna from the little flight service operator here in the local town, and we took off. We were flying around the Pajaro Valley of Central California. And we spotted this really interesting-looking farm kind of plugged into the south-facing slopes of the Santa Cruz Mountains. And we marked it on a map, and we went to visit Gert Schneider. And so the first thing we did when we walked into his business was we said, Gert, we're doing a book on making money with small parcels of land, and you have a small parcel, and you're a farmer, and what's your secret? And he looked at us, and he said, get the heck out of here. I have absolutely no time for you at all. But later, with a little persistence, he began to speak, and one of the first things he said was, people always think they need to get bigger, but that is not necessarily so. My work area is 140 feet by 40 feet. It will hold 500,000 cuttings. So, and when I looked at him and I looked at the surrounding area, I realized that there are people out there who are doing this. And we, Marlene and I and some friends got together and we formed a little research team and we found them and we interviewed them. And together they formed the foundation for our book, Metro Farm. And so that's kind of how Metro Farm came into being. 10 years of research and there it is.
It took a while. So, Michael, what has been the reaction by agriculture to your book, Metro Farm?
Well, of course, when the book came out, people looked at me and said, you're nuts, and you can't do this, and it doesn't work. And there's two reasons they said that. Reason number one, it was because it goes against the economic orthodoxy of the times, which was you got to get big or get out, period. And the second was they didn't want competition. I mean, if you're very big, you don't want anybody competing with you, and you do what you can to get rid of the competition. That's the natural course of events.
So we'll be right back. You are tuned in to the 1,000th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Marlene Olson with Food Chain host Michael Olson, now guest. Today we are asking Michael to prove up his contention that a small farm can be both beautiful and profitable. You are invited to participate with your questions and comments. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, and on the Food Chain Forum at metrofarm.com. The question for today is, how can one growing on a small parcel of land compete with the Goliaths of agriculture and agribusiness and win the consumer dollar? When we return, we will discuss the strategy and strategies to compete and win.
Hey, she's beautiful too.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Welcome back. This is the 1,000th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. I am Marlene Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we have turned the tables on host Michael Olson and turned the Food Chain's host into the Food Chain's guest to defend the assertion made in his book, Metro Farm, that it is possible to earn a substantial living on a small parcel of land. Michael, how much can be earned and how small the farm?
Great question. How much money can we learn farming for the city, in or near the city, for the city? You know, when we put together Metro Farm, we ran around looking for people who are actually doing this, and we collected five of them throughout the western United States, indicative that people can grow in the city, in the warm country, in the cold country. It didn't really matter. What mattered is how astute you were as a business person. You know, so how much do you make? How much money do you make is the question we asked, and they all look at me like, you expect me to tell you how much money I'm making? Not gonna happen. But, you know, after working with him for a while, we came to an agreement in which we would ballpark it, and I would kind of thumbnail in and sketch it in for people. And they were making upwards of 8 times the average annual income and on as little as 1 acre of land. So it's really an amazing thing. But what was really amazing about these people that we profiled in Metro Farm, five of them, was that they're people just like you and I. Which is to say, they weren't brain surgeons or anything, but they were smart. They were astute. Only one of them had any kind of formal training in the business of agriculture. The rest of them picked it up as they went along. They started with a love of it, of growing things, and that grew into the business. And they realized quickly that the business was different than the avocation. Go ahead.
How can one growing on a small parcel of land compete with the Goliaths of agribusiness and win the consumer dollar, Michael?
Well, it's the question that everybody must ask. How can I do this? How can I go up against the glass of agriculture and win? No matter what you grow, you're going to have to compete with somebody who's growing a lot of it on a very big scale. So how are you going to compete with them? You got to come to grips with that elemental fact of life. And pretty much this can be said, that's the same thing that can be said with almost any small business. No matter what you do, you're going to have to compete with somebody who's much bigger than you. So how do you go about doing it? Now, the first thing about metropolitan agriculture is you have to realize that it's not a hobby. And people often think of it as a hobby. And as a matter of fact, when I do presentations and I talk about marketing and whatnot, and the need to contend, to compete. People always jump up. I can see a half a dozen people will jump up in the seminar and run for the door because they don't want to compete. They don't want the contention. They don't want the struggle. They want to move to the country, paint their mailbox blue, plant some petunias. People will come from miles around to buy the petunias. Not going to happen. So you have to come to grips with the nature of business. And when you're in business, it's a lot different than when you're doing a hobby. A couple of quick examples. I love growing fruit trees, and we have fruit trees in our front yard that are begging to be pruned. And I look at them and go, I'll get to you. I'll get to you. Yeah, it's all right. You know, I'll get to you guys. Just hang in there. I'll get to you. When you're in the business of fruit farming, that's not the way you think. You think, I have to do that right away. I have to take care of that. And you're on the edge, and your living is at risk. That was driven home to me very early in my life when I was at my grandparents' farm as a wee tyke. My brother and I were spend our summers on the farm. And one hot summer day, it was one of those dog days. It was really hot and dry and totally dull and boring and just too hot to do anything. And late in the afternoon, a great big storm rolled in over the Beartooth Range of the Montana Rockies. And it was thunder, and it was lightning, and it was so exciting. We jumped up and down. We're running around. There's little hailstones. It was the most exciting thing that happened for a long time. And my grandmother, she marched out into the yard, and she grabbed us each by the scruff of the neck. And she hauled us into her kitchen, and she put us on each on a chair, and she said, don't you move, don't you say a word. And she was terrified.
About losing a crop.
About losing her crop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really the difference between enjoying a hobby and making a living. You know, when your whole existence is at risk, it's a whole different tenor. And people have to bear that in mind when they start thinking about going into the business of farming. So we're back to this question then, just how you go about doing this. You know, there's two things to say, ways to approach this business of competition. If you're very, very big, you know, if like you're a Monsanto farmer and you've got 25,000 acres, you approach things one way. If you're a small farmer, you approach things another way. Now, there's two classic writers who talk about the competition in terms of warfare, but what they have to say is most useful. One of them is von Clausewitz, and he speaks for those who have marshaled great big armies. You know, it's like Patton versus Hitler in the Battle of the Bulge. You know, you have 100,000 troops here and 100,000 troops there, and how do you move them so that you win the competition? Well, that's really the kind of thinking you do if you're a DuPont or a Monsanto and you're working with, you know, millions of acres of crops in the ground and how you compete with those, how you contend with those crops. If you're a small farmer and you have an acre or two, whole different thing. How do you go about doing that? So it doesn't quite work that way. You have to find a different model. And the model for small farmers is essentially put down by a guy named Sun Tzu, a Chinese writer, way back when, in a book called The Art of War. And what Sun Tzu suggests is that when you're small, you have no choice but to compete with the Goliath's weaknesses and avoid the strengths. And so that is the essential job of a small farmer, is you compete with weaknesses and you avoid strengths. So when you look at agriculture, and it's very big. And I'm going to give you the essential core lesson of agriculture. And Dave Michaels, I'm going to need you here. Where are you? So, Jason, you're there. Turn the mic on.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, you're there. Okay, we have Marlene and we have Jason. Now, the essential strength of being really big is the strength of economies of scale. They have to understand this single principle, right? And I'm going to describe it in a way that'll be kind of easy to understand. Let's say, Marlene, you have 1 acre of land, right? Jason, you have a 1,000-acre farm. Got
Jason,
it?
Jason, you're the big guy.
Sounds good.
You're
Sounds
the big
good.
Guy, Jason. You got 1,000 acres. Marlene, you have 1 acre. Okay, let's say one day you each wake up and decide to go down to the tractor store and buy a $10,000 tractor, right? Jason, how much does your $10,000 tractor cost?
Well, we've got a dollar per acre on my end.
No, $10 per acre.
$10 per acre.
You got 1,000 acres, and you have a $10,000 tractor. So that tractor's costing you $10 an acre, right?
Yes.
Okay, Marlene?
Whoa, I'm on the high end of costs here, $10,000 an acre.
You're $10,000 an acre. So, okay, who's going to win the competition when you're using $10,000 tractors? Jason?
Well, it seems like I'm getting it done cheaper.
Yeah, okay, so you're the winner there. Now let me ask you this. What is the cost for Jason to buy a politician a $10,000 airplane flight to his favorite island in the Caribbean? How much is that going to cost you?
Hopefully not a dime more than $10,000.
$10 an acre, right?
I guess so.
So do you understand the principle of economies of scale? Marlene, how much is it going to cost for you to fly that politician?
It's also going to be $10,000, but holy smoly. How am I going to do that?
How are you going to do that?
1 acre of land.
So that is the essential. How do we compete with the economies of scale? This is the Food Chain.
We'll be right back. You can earn a substantial income, 8 times the average personal income, and more by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city for the city. If this assertion is true, we simply must ask, how can one grow for big profit on a small parcel of land? Michael, we were just talking about avoiding strengths and competing with weaknesses. Can you fill us in more?
Well, yeah, you know, when you look at Goliath Farms Incorporated, or when you look at a Monsanto, or you look at a DuPont, and you look at a Syngenta, you might go, oh my goodness, how on earth can I possibly compete with all of that size and all of that strength and all that money? It really looks incredibly different. You know, you have an acre and Jason in there has 1,000 acres. How in the heck are you supposed to compete with that? But, you know, as a business grows and gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, it also develops some pretty incredible vulnerabilities. And one of them, of course, is the most obvious one to anyone who eats food, is the kind of food that those giant firms and farms and processors manufacture. It tends to, in the first place, by virtue of its size, it develops a certain bureaucratic uniformity. And they kind of go the easiest way, the least expensive way, so they can wring every possible cent out of it. Just got this from some folks that email me. People email me things from all over the world. And this from GMO Free USA. They did a chemical analysis of Kellogg's Fruit Loops, right? Now, Kellogg's began its life as a purveyor to the United States of America, to the broad population, health food. They were going to sell health food to the population and make give people a healthy alternative to the things that they were eating. Now they're selling Fruit Loops, and GMO Free did a study on these and detected high levels of insecticide producing genetically engineered corn. Now, folks, that's corn that has been re-engineered to contain up to 3 kinds of Bacillus thuringiensis pesticides. These pesticides are designed to literally destroy the stomach of a insect pest that bites into any part of the plant. Insect bites into that plant, it dies. Okay.
You mean even the roots?
Any part, any cell on that plant. It's a complete pesticide infused through every cell in the plant. And also in the box of Fruit Loops, it detected the presence of glyphosate, which is the weed killer that you spray it on the field and it kills weeds dead.
Is that Roundup?
Yes, that's Roundup. Okay. Very good. So here we have a Goliath, one of the biggest, who earned its name for selling health food, and it's selling Fruit Loops manufactured with genetically modified corn and sweetened with genetically modified corn. Now, do you know anybody in the city whose hunger is satiated with Kellogg's Fruit Loops? No. People in the city don't want that kind of food. What they want is that which is unique and fresh and colorful and tasty and exciting. They want to be able to go to their neighbor and say, wow, look at this heritage dry farm tomato I found at the market. Oh, my God, you wouldn't believe how good it tastes. So when you're going up against the Goliaths of agriculture, and you stand back and really look at their strengths and look at their weaknesses, they have the strength of the economies of scale. And if you compete with them on money, you're not going to win.
So you're saying I shouldn't grow GMO corn on my acre. Is that right?
You know, that's exactly the point. You don't grow what they grow. They grow commodities. Right. They grow commodities like genetically modified corn, and they sell it to somebody who turns it into something else, and they put it in a fancy box, and they charge you a lot of money for it. Right. You don't grow that. You grow specialty crops for people in the city. And that, guess what, folks? That the city is where the money's at. And so that's what you used to go up against that giant of the marketplace. Now, As we got further and further into developing our Metro Farm book, we asked these farmers, you know, what's your secret? You know, how do you do this? Because the confusing thing about these folks was that they were so incredibly different. I mean, they were as different as a thumbnail, as a thumbprint on the land. It's like they were old and young. They were male and female. They were married and single. They were rich and poor. They rent, leased, and owned their land. They were growing small fruits on prairie bench lands. They were growing houseplants in coastal valleys. They were growing flowers on steep wooded hillsides. They were growing vegetables in city green belts and ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. So I kept looking at them going, what on earth are you guys doing that's right? Because I can't figure it out. Everybody's entirely different. And so, you know, they kind of look at me and shake their head and kind of amble off. And finally, one of them took me aside and said, look here, Olson, we don't do anything right around here. We do everything right around here. And I went away and thought, oh, darn, how am I supposed to do a pamphlet on making money by farming a small parcel of land when they do everything right? And what does that mean to do everything right? But when I sat down and thought about doing everything right, I realized that was the secret to making a big profit on a small parcel of land. It wasn't doing, you know, if somebody were to come up to you and say, wow, Marlene, I have developed the perfect purple rutabaga. People love them. If you plant this purple rutabaga on your 1 acre of land, people will come from miles around to buy them, which is true. But by the second season, there's going to be about 38 trillion acres of purple rutabagas, right? So it's not one thing you do. It's everything you do.
So you have to be one step ahead all of the time, don't you?
Well, isn't that what Sun Tzu would say in The Art of War?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the enemy pursues, you retreat. When the enemy retreats, you pursue.
And you can't be a bumpkin to do this, can you? I mean, you can't be the Webster's definition of farmer to make something like this happen.
Not if you want to survive in business. Mm-hmm. If you want to survive in business, you have to be extremely knowledgeable about the technologies of agriculture and the technologies of business. You can't just accept what you think is going to happen. You have to know. You have to have your thumb on the pulse of the market, which is what we're going to talk about when we come back. We're going to look at the 10 business strategies, the 10 ways each farmer increases the productivity of their small parcels of land.
Folks, we've turned the tables on Michael Olson today. He's not the host of the Food Chain. He's the guest. We'll be right back and looking forward to seeing you again on the Food Chain website at the forum page, metrofarm.com.
Or they can call too.
They can.
800-624-2665. And 831-479-1080. Folks, that's Marlene Olson is our host today. She's my wife. We're celebrating our 42nd anniversary this
week. And the 1,000th edition of Food Chain.
And it's a lot of fun. Thank you very much. We will be right back with the strategies to win and survive.
Hello out there. This is the 1,000th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. I am Marlene Olson, your host, and our guest is Michael Olson. Today we are talking about his book, Metro Farm, and in it he's made the assertion that small-scale agriculture can be up to 400% more productive per acre. Michael, how in the world can that be?
Well, let's play with that notion a little bit. You know, you look at agriculture, you look at the giants of agriculture, and you think, goodness sakes, they're so big and so technologically precise and so incredibly efficient. They must be the most productive thing on earth. But really not. Per acre, let's say we're trying to get to a position where we can get 400% more productive, which is more profitable per acre than the Goliaths of agriculture. How on earth would we do that? Well, in Metroform, we lay out 10 specific business strategies how people can actually go about becoming 400% and much more, actually, productive per acre than Goliaths of agriculture. The first thing you do, the first business strategy I lay on the line is that you have to figure out how to grow more product, more crops in a smaller parcel of land. Now, if you think about that, people go, well, how can you possibly be more productive than the giants of agriculture? Nobody knows how to do that, how to get more from less than they do. But, you know, if you think about it, their technology, their whole production system is designed for a large scale. And if you look for how to translate that to small scale, it doesn't really fit. Because how can you put a $150,000 tractor on an acre of land? It just doesn't work, right?
Hardly fit.
So this is really illustrated by F.H. King, who is the Secretary, U.S. Department of Agriculture. In the year 1900, F.H. King went to China and Korea and Japan. He's going to teach those Asian folks how to use modern technology to become much more efficient. But he ran into this really interesting phenomenon, and it was kind of like an epiphany for him, actually. In his book, Farmers of 40 Centuries, he says, and I quote, "The man walking down the road with his manure pail swinging from his shoulders informed us on his return that in his household there were 20 people to be fed, that from his garden of half an acre of land, he usually sold a product bringing in $400 in gold. The crop was cucumbers in groups of two rows 30 inches in part and 24 inches between the groups." Wow. 20 people from a half acre of land. Think about that, folks. And I continue. 4 acres of cucumbers handled by American field methods would not yield more than this man's half an acre. And he grows besides two other crops the same season. The difference is not so much in the activity of muscle as it is in the alertness and efficiency of the gray matter of the brain. So F.H. King, the Secretary of Agriculture, is looking at this space-intensive production technology and saying, here's something that that one half of his acres is equal to four acres of ours. So that's like eight times more productive per acre.
So that big tractor rolls over a few cucumber plants and they're gone.
So it just doesn't make any sense for a small parcel of land. So that's one strategy. And if you look at what F.H. King said, that's at least 800% more productive. That's just one strategy. Now there's other strategies too. We have 10 of them listed in the book Metro Farm and have so little time to go through them, but I'm going to list them really quickly here. You can raise the quality where they sell uniformity. You can sell special products. Time the sale. Capitalize on location. Become self-reliant. Conserve cash. Employ neighborly technologies. Fight for position. Control distribution. In conclusion, if you're looking to become 400% more productive than the giants of agriculture, you can do that with, I guess we're at 52. You can do that by focusing on each technology, each strategy gives you an incremental increase in the production. By growing more crops on a small parcel of land, you get X amount. By selling special products, you can get X amount. You know, when we went to visit Charles and Lois Hayne in Shepherd, Montana, they were growing cantaloupe. Now, we visited them one January. You can grow cantaloupe, you can buy cantaloupe anywhere in the United States 365 days a year. But when we went to visit the Haynes, their phone was ringing off the hook. "What is going on?" I asked. "Why are people calling you in January?" And Charles said, "Well," he showed us a little three-line classified ad in the Billings Gazette, "reservations now being accepted for Haynes Country Gardens cantaloupe." People were calling him up and his wife Lois in the middle of winter to reserve their cantaloupe that would not be ready for harvest for months and months and months. And furthermore, they were going to drive 30 miles out of the city to his farm to buy it. So it's not one strategy that gives you that competitive, that ability to compete with the Goliaths of agriculture. It's not one crop. It's not one business strategy. It's a number of them. First thing, the most important thing, is you don't do what they do. You don't grow commodities. You grow special crops.
Michael, this is the 1,000th edition of Food Chain Radio.
Are you taking over? I am taking over. Okay.
And we will be right back to discuss how people can start a small-scale project and earn eight times the average income. We'll be right back.
Okay, folks. And this is Marlene Olson, our host today, who is helping us out. We're most appreciative.
And this is Michael Olson, our guest, who thinks he's the host.
And that's Jason in there. Jason, you've got it. This is the Food Chain.
Metro Farm, Michael Olson. And Michael, how do we start a Metro Farm?
Well, great odd question. How on earth do we start? Where do I do? How do I get tuned into this world of food freedom? Well, first thing you do is you start growing plants. Any plant anywhere is just fine. Once you become accustomed to how plants grow, if you think about it, folks, the growth of green plants is the foundation upon which we build this earth. Without that photosynthesis, we would not be able to convert the radiant energy from the sun and the raw minerals from the earth into the stuff of our life. We need that. That is the foundation of agriculture. It is the foundation of everything. So if you really want to get tuned in to the business, that is the business. So start growing something, anything, anywhere. I suggest a bonsai in your house. If you don't have space, grow bonsai. Learn what it takes to grow a bonsai, because that's the ultimate in struggle right there. So learn about that. Second, start surveying the market. Why? Because that's where you get all the information. That market tells you everything. When your friend tells you to grow purple rutabagas, I don't know if I'd listen to that. I would ask the market what the market thinks of that first. And to really become a proficient at asking the market things, you have to become an industrial spy. You have to pretend you're a foreign agent, you know, gathering all of the precious information that you possibly can. You have to think of yourself as a spy. Third, you need to learn how to organize a business. That's the vehicle which you will use to get things done. If you don't organize a business, you'll never be able to organize a farm. And finally, you have to start thinking like a competitor and develop a strategy, a Metro Farm strategy, to go up against the Goliaths of the marketplace and win the consumer dollars.
What do you think out there? Can one growing on a small parcel of land compete with the Goliaths of agribusiness and win consumer dollar? Log on to the forums at metrofarm.com and make your case. Michael, thank you. And I just want to give you a few more moments to add to your contention of the average income. That's amazing.
Well, first thing I want to do is thank everybody out there. First, I want to thank the family for supporting me through the years. I want to thank the folks at our flagship here, KSEO in Santa Cruz, California, the owners, the managers, the staff, the engineers, the producers, the interns. Thank you all so much for standing up for us through the years. I want to thank the affiliates across the land, people out there, the radio stations carrying us throughout the United States. Thank you. And if you're listening to those affiliates, I want you to call them up and say thank you for carrying the food chain. I want to thank all of our sponsors, both the local ones and the national ones. Thank you for taking such good care of us. And most importantly, I want to thank all you listeners out there. If you stop and think about how much you are changing our world, oh my goodness, it's absolutely incredible, because I'm here to tell you, we have Monsanto on the run. Thank you so much.
We hope to see you all next week for more of What's Eating What Radio, right here on the Food Chain. Remember, Michael Olson's first law of the food chain: agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all of our sandcastles.
And Marlene Olson, thank you so much for guest hosting today. What fun it is to work with one's own wife. Wow. Thank you.
Yahoo.
All right, Mr. Jason, it's all yours, buddy. Take it away. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.